my staff person to get back to her position there. Good afternoon, everybody. Today is Health and Social Services Day. We are going to get started at 1:35. We have three members present, Vice Chair Passman, Senator, and Senator Ellis, and myself, Betty Davis, Chair. We are going to be having a presentation, first of all, before we get to the bills that we have on the schedule for today. And it's about foster care in Alaska. I would like for the people to come forward that's going to do the presentation.
And I want to make sure we have 15 minutes, right?
Oh, you. If it takes a little longer than that, it's okay.
Didn't
know she said 15 minutes. We do have two other bills that we have to take up. How long do you need?
50, I can do it in 15. That's fine.
Oh, I thought you had a set.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, if it's longer than 15 minutes, we'll be okay. We don't want you to go maybe 30, 35 minutes because we have other bills, but...
So I'm Amanda Mativier, and I'm the statewide coordinator for Facing Foster Care in Alaska. And this is Farron Hines. She's also one of our members.
Hines,
H-I-N-E-S, mm-hmm. In town from Anchorage. And I know you have all been really supportive of a lot of the foster care reform efforts. And what we do as an advocacy group is we work to advocate for changes to the foster care system by sharing some of our personal experiences. We recently completed a digital storytelling project where we outlined 12 stories of our members on the topics of permanency, education, and culture. And so we wanted to show a few of those here today, and they're short clips. They're only a couple minutes long. And I'll just, I guess, warn you that they're not the best quality because the actual DVDs are still in production and not finished, but these are the final cut before the final cut. So I guess we'll go ahead and get started. So I'll start out with Courtney, and Courtney's is on the topic of education.
I'm 21 years old and a member of a youth and alumni group. I have six brothers ranging from 3 to 20. I was in foster care for 3 years. I was separated from 3 of my brothers. Imagine how that would feel. On top of that, I've also been in over 20 different placements. I went to North Star, a behavioral hospital, on 2 separate occasions and was in residential treatment for nearly a year. While in foster care, I got made fun of at school because foster children are different compared to other children. I hated going to school. It made me depressed. I went to 2 different middle schools and later withdrew from both. They just passed me on to 9th grade and I went to East High School. I was still getting picked on, so I just stayed in EWE, which was Elitnarvik within East. It's the native program. The teachers that were in the program were really helpful in trying to get me transportation to school when I was going. So school went on and I started skipping as a result of being depressed, missing my family, and not being able to talk to them. I went without talking to them for the first 3 months I was in care. I failed my freshman and sophomore years and then gave up on school completely. After ending my school career, I moved back with my mom, and a month later, so did my youngest brother. Being back home was great. I was able to spend a lot of time with my brothers, and it was the best feeling that I felt in a long time. Today I'm doing an internship with the Community Service Center and working on my GED. I really enjoy working with the youth that I come in contact with.
I'm that star up in the sky, I'm that mountain peak up high. Hey, I'm
I'll cut the credits to save time. The next one is Marie, who Marie currently lives in Anchorage. And I'm sure as many of you know that for youth who age out of the foster care system, about 40% end up homeless. And Marie actually aged out of the system to homelessness. She used to live in Kotzebue and moved to Anchorage due to lack of placements in the village.
Do you ever feel like breaking down? Do you ever feel out of place? Like somehow you just don't belong and no one understands you? Do you ever want to run away?
I've been in and out of Alaska's Child Protective Services since the age of one.
No one hears you screaming. No, you don't know.
Numerous foster homes, treatment facilities, and kinship care due to my mother's alcoholism.
To feel hard, to be left out in the dark, to be kicked when you're down, to feel like...
A couple of years ago, when I lived in Kotzebue, Alaska, I stayed at Puchuk, the local children's home.
Welcome to my life.
It was great. I had friends, a boyfriend, and finally, I didn't have to worry about migrating through school districts because there's only one school. That all changed the day my cousin came to visit. She brought me some Nickelback, which is native food. But when the staff saw what I had, they told me I couldn't eat it because it wasn't approved by the FDA. Now let's just get one thing straight. I'm an Alaska native. Food is a really big part of my culture. Some would even consider it a culture in itself. So you can imagine the shock, outrage, and sadness I felt when I learned the first side effect of being in foster care. The loss of my culture.
To be hurt, to feel lost, to be left out in the dark, to be kicked when you're dead.
And obviously Marie's was on culture. This next one is Angel, and Angel's is on permanency.
I've been in foster care on and off for as long as I can remember. My birth mom was an alcoholic and always had a mud duck for a boyfriend. Some of them would beat her right in front of me. There were even a couple of times when she tried to kill me when she blacked out from being so intoxicated. I've been abused in every way possible. I've been told that I would never amount to anything and would only be good for lying on my back. There were some who believed that I wouldn't even graduate from high school. Being the oldest, I took care of my two younger brothers. As a result of all of this, we would be taken away and often separated, no matter how much I begged and pleaded for us to stay together.
Hold your head up high and be of good cheer.
When I was 13, my birth mom died. I prayed hard for God to give her back. My youngest brother and I were moved to my aunt's house. My eldest brother was separated from us. A month later, we were taken away from our aunt too. We went to a 30-day emergency foster home and then moved in with the Adams family. I didn't expect to be there for long. I thought that they were going to be just like everyone else. Here today, gone tomorrow. Regardless of what I thought, they treated us just like family, not like foster children. They even took us down south to meet their family and introduced us as my daughter, my son, and my sister, my brother. I even remember my mom being as excited as I was about us going shopping down south because we were going to have clothes that none of the other school kids had. Before long, they started talking about adopting us. Doubt coursed through my thoughts until the very day we got adopted and were standing in the courtroom. It was the happiest I had ever been. The only one missing was my eldest brother, but he didn't want to get adopted. Nevertheless, it was the greatest day of my life. God had blessed me with the family that I had always wanted, the family that my brother and I deserve.
And this, I think this will be the last one, so we don't take up too much time. But this next one is Becca, and Becca's story is also on permanency.
Becca, and I'm currently a ward of the state. I've been in custody for just over 6 years now, but I've been on my own for a lot longer than that. I grew up taking care of myself with little help from anyone else. My mom would constantly disappear, and my brother was the only person standing between loneliness and I.
I just called to see if you still have a place for me.
I entered foster care during junior high. After coming into custody, I was separated from my brother. While he was lucky enough to only have a few placement changes, I had to endure switching homes several times. So many stereotypes. So many assumptions. So many reasons. So many. I've had to stay at homeless shelters, treatment facilities, and even on the streets. I did not find a permanent placement until after a failed reunification with my mother, 23 different placement changes, and an abundance of challenges.
Feels like I've been everywhere, but someday I'll be coming home.
I've been in my current living situation for almost 2 years now, and I can honestly say that it has made an enormous impact on my life. I am currently a sophomore at my local university, a full-time photographer, and the statewide representative of our state's youth and alumni group. I believe that permanence has not only changed, but bettered my outcomes and life chances exponentially, and every youth in care should have the right to experience that.
Soldier gone to war, another story told before. Now it's told again. It seems the wars will never end. We'll make it home again, back where we belong again. We're holding on to when we used to dare to dream. Someday I'll be coming home. Round and round the world will spin. Oh, the circle now.
That's it.
Is that the last one? You got a show?
I could do one more.
Oh, that would be fine. I wish we had time for all 12.
I'll do one more.
But sure.
Ever since I can remember, alcohol was a part of my family. Being born to two wonderful parents only to find out their wonders were hidden deep inside their own hearts. Observing my parents' uncontrolled arguments escalate to heart-aching fights. Being so young and helpless, what was I to do? Was I born to watch wrestling matches in my own home? Was I meant to have first-class seats and watch in terror? From the beginning to the end, my heart was full of fear. My eyes would puff from all the raging tears that flooded my soul. Soon enough, my fear would mutate to madness. Thinking since I was just a child, my own father would not dare lay his titanium hands on me. Foolishly, I started beating my dad's shirtless back, though to my father it was as if I were beating drums. Annoyed of my out-of-tune drumming, my father grabbed my wrists and twirled me faster than a tornado. Then released me onto the floor with broken glass stained with their liquor. Seeing my two older brothers, then my mom surround me as if I were dead. My fading sight seemed inevitable. Soon enough, I was at the clinic the next day, appointed for a painful shot. Being only enrolled in Head Start, I was afraid of needles. Struggling from fear, I was held down for the shot. Alcohol seemed to be the ruler of the house. Alcohol ruled my father and sentenced his life to death. My mom's depression over the years grew because of alcohol. Getting taken away felt like I was thrown down a flight of stairs. With this on and off falling, I soon realized that the state was helping my mom, and it seemed as if I had to pay for her trials. Taking my steps one at a time with friends and advocates by my side was hard, but even with their disappearing, words of hope brought happiness. I was once told there is a balance for everything. For so long I thought of that negative side. Soon enough that balance took place. We are given a chance to walk away from the dark thunderous storm. Or we could walk with the storm. But remember, the rolling storm can strike us dead. When the storm reapproaches, is it not only natural that we find shelter in our own homes in order to remain dry? What if we are a mile away from shelter and find that the storm travels with you? Would you then walk a mile back to stay away from the storm? Remember, we are only human, bound for mistakes. Temptation comes and goes and may linger. Always know where you stand, know your forecast.
I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to see those slides there. I want to first, before we go any further, to bring to the attention that we do have Les Guerra in the audience with us, Representative Les Guerra. And he's worked so hard on many of the bills that we have out there now and the many programs that foster care is involved with. He's been right there, having been a former foster child himself, and understand some of the situations that foster kids find themselves in. He's quite an advocate. And I also want to recognize that we have Linda Bernard, who's senator on the Senate side here, in the audience. Is there anybody else that's in the legislature that's here? And I don't, oh yeah, Charlie Huggins. I hadn't looked to the left. So glad that you could be here. And if there's anybody else back there that I'm not recognizing, I can't see you. Hold your hand up, and somebody will tell me, okay? But I want to give special thanks to Les, and I want to give special thanks to Amanda and your organization, having been a former foster child, knowing the heartaches and things that you had gone through and wanted to make things better for other foster children as they come along, and you're doing that. But you didn't do that alone. You had somebody along the way to help you. I see that we have Rasmussen Foundation to give you funding for this. I see that we have Casey Foundation, who's always been out there working on foster care, and we want to thank them for the support that they have given you and hope that you will be able to continue up with your work. I'm going to give my, and I also want to recognize that I have another one of the members here that came in while the presentation was going on. I want to give recognition to Senator Thomas, also on the committee. I guess I would like to find out from my members if they have anything they would like to say or a question they want to ask. But before they do that, and I don't want to get too emotional doing this, you know, one of my main jobs before I became, well, before I went to the school board, I was foster care coordinator in Anchorage as a social worker. And so I spent a lot of time working with foster children, foster families, and trying to find decent homes for them and keep them in place. There's so much work to be done. But that one slide that you showed up there on Angel, and I want to say to every one of the ones that you showed, I know Angel. Angel's in a home that is a cousin of mine that I brought to the state to work for me some years ago, who now is a foster parent and has adopted many of the foster children that come through a home. That's the Adam family. And they've been written up many times in Anchorage for the work that they do. And I just want to say I appreciate the fact that she and her husband are there for many, many kids, foster or adopted. But she takes some of that from me, her cousin. I think I taught her well. She came here from Louisiana, and she's made an outstanding name for herself. And I also want to know if you, I didn't write your last name down.
Hines.
Did you have a statement that you wanted to make?
No.
Or were you?
I'm just sitting here for support.
Just for support. Are you?
She's one of our members.
She's one of the former foster. Okay. All right, I'll open it up to the members here on the committee. If they have a statement to make or a question to ask. Senator Thomas.
Not a statement to make. I was just curious. First of all, what are the ages of the kids we just saw? Currently, when the clips were made, what were their ages?
We just finished this project in November, and so all I think the ones that I showed are between the ages of 18 and 20.
Thank you.
You had something else to add? Oh, okay, Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amanda, what's the next step? I mean, you all have been doing a lot of work. We've had some limited incremental steps of progress along the way with legislation and budget items. What are you hoping to achieve this session in terms of policy or budget items?
Well, I think some of the major things are, I know one of the major things would be educational stability, because I think it shined through in Courtney's and Marie's story, and we see it a lot in Anchorage, is that as youth bounce between foster homes and other placements, they bounce between schools and they fall behind. And by the time they get to high school, they're so far behind that they're not graduating. Last year, I think it was in May, I just spoke with the Anchorage School District's Child in Transition Program, and only a quarter of the ninth graders, freshmen, were on track to graduate on time. And so they're not making it through high school, and then they're getting out of custody at 18. And if they don't achieve permanence before they age out of the system, then they don't have a family or support system to fall back on. And so I know there's a lot of things right now in the current legislation around educational stability, but also things for youth in transition around extending foster care to 21, tuition waivers for youth who do age out of the system. Currently, the state provides 10. 12 young people applied for the waiver last year, but it only goes out to 10. And usually, for the most part, if they don't get it that first time, then they're not going to try again because they're struggling with things like housing and trying to support themselves.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Do you have any clip? Will you send? Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have your hand again? Okay. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Regarding the number of kids in the system, depending on the age group you work with, which I just read that I think was 16 or?
Our members are ages 15 to 24.
Okay. In that group, what are the potential foster homes for them versus the amount of kids that are in need of foster homes?
Well, I don't know the number in terms of if you're asking if there's a lack of foster homes. I know right. There's a lack. I know that in Anchorage, a lot of our older youth are placed at Covenant House, and so they stay at the shelter there off and on as they're in custody. And I think it depends on where you are in the state. I know in Marie's story, she talked about staying at the local children's home. So I think it depends on where you are in the state. But I think it's the lack of placements is higher for youth that are older, because I think people are more hesitant to take in teenagers.
Okay, all right, thanks.
Okay, before we close out on the foster care segment here, I'm going to ask for Representative Gower to come up. We do have legislation that's out there, and I don't want to blow my own horn, but I think that he can talk about some of the legislation and what we can do if some of it's passed during this session that would assist you in some of the concerns that you have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, the truth is Amanda is a better advocate for this than I am. I mean, Amanda worked with both of her offices on telling us what they thought was needed. So I think there are things that the folks in Facing Foster Care are pushing that we can do as budget items. I think obviously legislation would work out better, but as the things Amanda said, you know, there's a discussion in the building on university financial aid, and the question is going about what grade should you get to qualify. And I think from the stories you can see that the effort that a child who has a stable family has to engage in to, let's say, get a C+ average is different than the effort that somebody who's bounced between 10 or 15 homes has to engage in to get a C+ average. So I hope as folks are considering what the qualifications are for whatever we pass, we try and figure out a way to address the reality, which is it's a bigger struggle for somebody who's gone through some of this stuff to be a C+ student or a B student than it is for some other folks. And there's no easy way to address that, so I don't have any amazing solution right now. But yeah,
I thought you might want to mention a couple of the bills that's out there that we're trying to pass. You don't want to bring that up at this point. We can close out and move on to the next thing that we have. I know that we're looking for funding. We're trying to get some funding out there. The only comment that I'd like to make, foster children have to be treated different than what we would say the average child is coming through and looking for scholarships. And since we have certain programs out there to address those, we still need to be pushing for funding for those youngsters. Foster care. Don't want to just throw them in the pile with everybody else and say, lower the standards because foster kids didn't meet that particular thing. To have something out there that they can apply for. You say we got 10 slots that's available. Maybe we want to have 20 slots. Maybe we want to have an unlimited number of slots. There's lots of things that can be worked on that would assist foster children, young people who have aged out of foster care, homeless, nowhere to live, all kinds of things that need, and we are pushing for them to be able to stay within the school where they went into foster care rather than have to move from one home to another home and change schools every time when you're within the city. As that one youngster said on there, I was glad when I moved to Kosovo because they had one school and I knew I didn't have to move from school to school every time I changed home. It makes a big difference in their lives. And so there's a lot of work that's been done, and I thank you, Amanda. And I hope that you will come back to visit us again soon with more success. Okay?
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Okay, we'll take a brief at ease at this point so we can switch over to the bills that we have to hear. Yes. We're going to take up Senator Huggins' bill at this time. Turn it over to him.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. Charlie Huggins, Senate District H, and...
Good afternoon. My name is Sharon Long. I'm legislative staff to Senator Huggins.
That's a hard act to follow. My wife is a alternative school principal, and she sees lots of kids that resemble some of the videos we watch there, and we always have to be mindful of the challenge that others face, and I'm proud of my wife for being part of the solution to that. But it's tough. It's very difficult. Madam Chairwoman, if I might, today we're here to talk to you and the committee members about health, our health, about oral health. And, you know, in the context of a larger national debate, which number of people all over the place, and some people are discouraged, others are happy, but be that as it may, this bill presents an opportunity for us at the grassroots level to get our fingerprints and shape something that will work for young people in their oral health. And we all know that how discouraging it is to see young people, or old people for that matter, that older people may not have any teeth. We've talked about you know, the dentures and being able to do it 1 year. In this case, though, this is about young people. On one end of the spectrum, young people that are just single digit in age, might be 2 years old, might be 2 years and months or 3 years old, that they can go potentially have their mouth looked at in their oral health. Because, you know, quite frankly, I remember, and I look back at my class pictures when I was in elementary school, there's one thing that was consistent. There were different colored hairs of different people and complexion and all those sorts of things. But for those that were smiling, most had cavities. Most had cavities, rarely apparent, to include myself. And we've come a long ways in that. And this bill enters us into a conversation about that challenge, and has the insurance industry, in one respect, has the dental society, which we brought this bill forward to assist that, so we could have that conversation, so you could shape this bill for the youth, in this case, of our state. And this now, so we got it in context, it's about young people with single-digit age and older kids that can be covered under a family plan or whatever the case may be until they're aged out, and that's kind of the envelope we're looking at. The first part is so that this bill represents an effort to not have a minimum age factor that would not be coherent to create that health. And as you notice, maybe you haven't noticed, there's about 20 states that this legislation has been introduced in, and I think it's passed in one, so the conversation is going on in about half of our country in that respect. And the other piece, which probably a little confusing to most of us, is the fact that there's a question whether or not an insurance company should be able to cap fees that's not covered by the insurance company. And that's a debate that we will hear from the industry, we'll hear from the professionals, because today we have David Logan here with us from the Dental Society, Alaska Dental Society. We have Ms. Linda Hall from the insurance industry, and we know what a professional she is. And finally, we have Pat here from the Department of Retirement and Benefits, and we'll hear there. But I guess I am proud to be here speaking to you today, because this is not about anything other than us being able to shape and do what's right for our young kids and our community in the context of, it doesn't matter how large it is, we take care of ourselves. So with that, Sharon Long is much smarter on this subject than I am, and we have some professionals here that can talk to some of the details. And with that, I say thank you very much.
Thank you. We do have Linda present. You want to come up and speak on the divisions?
I'm done, Madam Chair. I think there's little I can add to what Senator Huggins said today, except that there are some contracts in effect in the state today that do what we're terming as fee capping. Right now, they are in effect in the state now.
Yeah, I would allow you to say that then before she speaks.
Yeah.
if you have other comments to be made?
That's it.
Oh,
okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. I really did not prepare any testimony. I had signed up for questions. And the only thing that I would state, I'm going to hold this up. Many of you have seen it before. It's a pie chart, obviously. You want to see this? This yellow segment of this pie chart represents the part of the Alaska insurance marketplace that the Division of Insurance regulates. It's the private marketplace. These other colors represent, the orange one is self-insureds who are governed under federal law, under the ERISA programs, various Medicare, Medicaid, uninsured. So the only real information that I would add to this discussion is that when we do various kinds of mandates, changes, prohibitions to insurance programs, that little orange piece of the pie is really all they apply to. And I'm not going to really go into a lot of detail unless you have questions about it, but sometimes, and I have given this kind of presentation before, what we're doing when we make these kinds of changes is impacting individuals and small groups. We're not impacting larger employers, usually anything over 100 employees. The employer will choose to do some type of a self-insured program. Not always. We do have a few large groups that actually have an insurance program. But that would be my caution when we look at things like this, that we recognize that it is a policy call, I believe, for the legislature to make, whether you want to do the things that are in this bill. But I would just throw out who it impacts and who it doesn't. And I don't have any position on this bill. I think it is a policy call, as the sponsors indicated. And I would answer any questions if there are any.
Yes, we've heard you make that statement when we have bills coming with this kind of mandate. And I do understand we're talking about small business and the individual businesses that have their own insurance or whatever. But wouldn't that give us a chance to also go back, even though the bill may just cover those people, to, as they review the, say, the state plan, we could mandate that they abide by that, could we not? Is there anything to keep us from doing that as a legislature?
Madam Chairman, no, I think you can do that. If you choose to have it apply to the state plan, that is something the legislature could add to the legislation. We can't preempt federal law to have this type of thing apply to the self-insured groups because they are regulated federally. And there are different qualifications for Medicare and Medicaid, but the state plan, Director Shire is here. I think he may be able to speak to that also.
Okay. Any questions? Yes, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. In the case of the bill, though, when we're talking about the number of folks that that are impacted or by the bill, as far as particularly the area that, as it states in the bill, a health care insurer who provides coverage for dental care may not include in a health care insurance plan or contract a provision that prohibits a covered person from obtaining dental care services from a dentist of personal choice, including a specialist. But with most of the others, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I should ask it differently. But of that other two-thirds or whatever it amounts to, how many of those already do what also is stated in the bill? They allow there to be a different tier of compensation if you go outside of the preferred provider. I guess that's what you're talking about, right, is those others, the ERISA and some of the other programs that exist, generally they have established a preferred provider, so if you go to that preferred provider, they pay a lesser rate. This still allows the person to go to another person, a specialist or their own choice, but just pay a different rate. How many would then be affected just in general I realize the same number is affected by the bill, but as far as the concept, if I'm making myself clear, you're including more now with the idea that you're able to pay a differing rate.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I'm not sure that I... There's still... This would not impact a preferred provider network, either in the private marketplace or in the self-insured marketplace. So I'm not sure I'm understanding what you're asking.
Well, I guess I'm asking, if I may.
You may.
You said that only the orange part of the chart is affected by this bill. So when we would do something like prevent somebody from implementing a policy that says you have to only go to these providers, we are only affecting one third or whatever the orange part of the chart is. But if you look at the other provision, one of the other provisions in the bill, it does allow somebody to change the rate, so it allows them to go to other dentists that are not within the preferred provider group. So to me, as long as you are allowing someone to go outside of the preferred provider group and just be paid a different rate, it seems like a fair compromise of the two provisions, basically, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, yeah, that part about allowing an individual to go to the dentist of their choice is already in statute. I think what this bill is doing, and I don't want to do the interpretation of somebody else's bill, but I think you have kids on both ends. You have the middle number of insureds, and it says an insurance company cannot prevent, they can't put a cap that you can't, they don't have to offer coverage under 6 or under 5, that it's appropriate to offer dental coverage to young kids. I'm not sure that that is or is not in insurance contracts today. I was not aware that there was a capping that we didn't do dental work on young kids. I think we do, and this would continue that. On the other end, it says that insurance company may put an age cap on a dependent. So an insurance company could cap, say, coverage as they do in health insurance. You could put a cap on a 21-year-old. You cover up to 21 and full-time student or up to age 26, that we are allowing a cap on that end, but we're not allowing a minimum on the other end. Those are the two age-related pieces of the bill. And I don't think there's anything that prevents going to a dentist of your choice. We've had that discussion before. Am I answering your question?
You're answering part of two questions. That's good. Thank you.
Senator Pascal?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the other types of coverage, whether it's direct federal coverage or ERISA plan coverage, do they prohibit establishing a minimum age for receiving dental care? In other words, it's kind of out of your direct field, but just wondering if whether you are aware whether they do or do not.
Through the chair, Senator Pascal, I'm really not aware. I don't know. I think when you have particularly the large employer groups, they design their own plan to meet the needs of their employees. So I think it could be a variety of things. I don't think there's like a standard such as those standards we apply in statute to the insured plans.
Just to comment on what you had said, I know this bill, the way it is in its form, would only cover that small segment in there. But many of the plans that's out there may be already meeting this mandate. Because if they were not meeting that mandate, I believe more people would be here to testify and saying, oh no, this is going to cause us a problem. We don't want that. Because it's going to increase the premium, it's going to do this or whatever it's going to do. And at this point, I haven't even seen from small businesses where they've come forward and say, oh, we don't support this at all. Maybe you could do it this way and I might support it. They're not saying that. But would you not agree that some people are already doing this?
Madam Chairman,
asking to do?
I would agree that I think even in the private insurance marketplace, we have coverage for young children, and we cap coverage as a dependent at a certain age. And it will vary. We see that vary from insurer to insurer. So I think some of the intent of the bill is to be proactive for things that we're seeing in other parts of the country and maybe here to start to put in contracts. I mean, there is a third piece of the bill that I think is probably an even bigger policy call on behalf of the legislature, if I might.
Yes.
And that's the part that I've had heard discussion and been involved in discussion, that whether or not it's appropriate for an insurance company to negotiate with dentists or to put in their contract prices for services that the insurance company does not pay for. So they really have no impact. They have no involvement. I'm going to use an example that just it's a make-believe example. But for example, if a dental policy did not cover orthodontia, but the insurance company put in their contract that the patient would only pay X amount toward orthodontic work, that's the kind of thing that is, to me, the policy call in the bill. Do you as legislators want to speak on what should or should not be in the contract between the insurance company and the dentist? I am not making any kind of statement because I do think that is truly a policy call.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else here from any division that want to speak to this bill? Department?
Pat Shire.
Come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Shire. I'm the Division Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And the question has arisen, does this bill affect the employee health plans with the state and the retiree health plan? And I'm here simply to confirm that as far as we read it, it would not apply. However, we also do not have a coverage floor for young children that would affect them. Our typical age out provisions are very similar to what's already in effect for most plans. But that's my entire testimony unless you had further questions.
Anybody have a question? Yes, Senator Fassbender.
What I'm, I guess, if I understand the two components, first of all, there is no minimum age under the state's current plan.
Through the chair, that's correct, Senator Pascoman.
And then the second component, you know, you indicate that there are maximum ages when a person would age out, and that is established by the state of Alaska, isn't it?
Through the chair, Senator Pascoman, our plans are modeled after insurance products that were in place back in the 90s, and as typical, they do have a requirement where an individual be a student beyond age 18 in order to continue to receive coverage as a dependent under a parent's plan who's a member, and that extends up to, through age 22. On their 23rd birthday, they would be no longer covered, and that's typical in the industry.
What I'm, if I may, Madam Chair, is, you know, this would permit the insurer to set the maximum age, and you know, it's somewhat different, I think, than the state's currently sets the maximum age and then purchases coverage towards that, or?
Madam Chairman, Senator Pascoman, it's a self-insured plan. We don't purchase coverage outside.
Right. You set it, and then you self-insure to that.
Right.
This says that the insurer sets the age that one would age out at, as compared to the employer setting the age.
Madam Chair, Title 21, it appears that it would give the insurer that, and that's outside my jurisdiction. I would defer to Linda Hall, but that's the way I read it as well. I'd venture that far.
Okay. Another question. That complete your statement? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. David Logan?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Logan. I'm here representing the Alaska Dental Society, at least as long as my voice holds out. And I'm also a practicing dentist here in Juneau. The bill has, we would like to thank Senator Huggins for bringing this bill forward. We think that this is a valuable bill for the consumers of Alaska. There's essentially two portions to the bill. The prohibition on setting an age restriction will do two important things for the delivery of healthcare in Alaska. Over the past couple of years, we've worked hard with the dental board to allow reimbursement for medical providers under dental reimbursement, and we would hate to lose that because now we're seeing the providers actually, as part of their well baby checks, now starting to look inside mouths, apply some fluoride, do some valuable things. And unfortunately, in this state, we are still number one in the nation in leading in baby bottle caries. And unfortunately for children and parents facing this devastating problem, sometimes the ability to receive some reimbursement from their dental benefits makes the difference between whether they can afford that coverage, afford to proceed with that care, or not. Shifting gears a little bit, the other portion regarding fee capping on non-covered services. Excuse me. When that first came out, I think I reacted like most dentists did, and a fair number of legislators that I've mentioned this to. And the first question is, they can do that? We were a little surprised. Turns out that they can. When you're the ones who set the terms of a contract, it's amazing the things you can do. To briefly describe how the negotiation process works with dental contracts, and I'm using negotiation with air quotes around it, there is no negotiation. The dental insurance companies provide a contract that they market to the dentists. You have your choice of signing that contract or not signing that contract. But there's no individual negotiation that takes place. Sadly, it's an on-level playing field in the dental industry. The insurance companies enjoy an antitrust exemption. We enjoy a special little piece of antitrust hell, unfortunately. We, about 10 years ago, 15 now I guess it is, we were prohibited from regulating dental advertising any longer. There was a very long lawsuit, took 10 years to be resolved before that was settled. And the outcome of it is now, even if a dentist chooses to put bald-faced lies in a Yellow Pages advertisement, we're prohibited because of antitrust law from taking any action on that. So our ability to speak to contracts, to look at contracts, to work as most other industries would as a trade group is prohibited. We individually assess the contracts. We can talk with specialists like accountants, lawyers, etc., but we can't discuss it with other dentists, the pros and cons of the contracts. We can't get together as a group and try and negotiate different terms. All we can do is simply decide to sign the contract or not sign the contract. Part of the reason dentists sign up for these contracts is an expectation that as entering into a contract with a managed care company, you will have a number of patients directed towards your office. The theory is that, and it's a little bit of dental black humor, is while you lose something on every patient, you make it up in volume. Now, part of that is that, as many industries do, a supermarket, for instance, some of the services that are covered, while delivered at cost or below cost, are loss leaders. You deliver other costs that generally tend to be more voluntary, other services that are more voluntary, orthodontics, cosmetic work being two examples there, that you charge your normal fee structure for. As part of your contract with the insurance company, you agree to abide by your standard fee structure for services that aren't covered by the insurance company, and you discount your fees for the services that are covered, typically somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 70% of your normal fee structure. And dental practices, like any industry in Alaska, have to remain profitable if they're to stay in business. If we were to deliver our services at cost or below cost, it would be nice. I would like to be able to go to my office tomorrow and open the doors and say, come on in. I would also like to be able to stop by the supermarket on the way home and fill my shopping basket up and only pay the supermarket's costs when I leave, and the same when I purchase gasoline or the other varieties of services that we all purchase on a daily basis. Unfortunately, it's not reality. A business needs to, in order to remain in business, it needs to remain profitable. I would agree that, especially with everything happening in healthcare today, we all have a responsibility to try and provide services in the most cost-efficient manner, but we would ask that this be not mandated strictly of dentists, but also of the other providers of insurance there, of healthcare. We're all familiar with the going to the hospital and getting our hospital bills there that show a $10 Tylenol or an outrageous expense for gauze. We know that those don't have anything to do with the real cost, but they do represent cost shifting. And that is the advent of allowing a group such as the managed care companies to force costs lower on that. These costs won't evaporate. They'll get shifted to another party. And unfortunately, these costs will be continuously borne across. Their dentistry to this point has managed to avoid the segment of cost shifting that has racked other areas of healthcare and led to many of the horror stories that we've heard nationally in the past couple of years. Have to question why the insurance industry opposes this legislation. Are they interested in the consumer, or is this a case of they're interested in their own profit margin? Dentists have a long relationship with our patients. People find a dentist they like, they stay with the dentist for years. We all have stories about patients who've moved outside that still come back to receive their dental work because they've developed a level of trust and confidence in their dentist. Driving a wedge in between that with forcing people out of networks, out of their providers as these programs take place there will disturb the patient care that's being offered in the state, and it will drive a wedge within that relationship. We feel that if the insurance companies were sincere in their effort, the solution would be simple. They would take these services and they would pay a benefit on that. They would become a covered service at that time and no longer subject to the prohibition on fee capping that this bill would set. And if that happens, then it's a shared responsibility between the dentist and the insurance company. The insurance company is setting a fair premium, charging that to employers, and covering the consumer. The dentist is agreeing to a discounted fee structure to provide that structure. At that time, everybody is successful in that. As it stands right now, though, the insurance companies want to limit our fees without making any sacrifice on their part. It does have an increased profit motive for them, as they can then in turn market these plans to employers, but in doing so at the expense of dental offices. Sadly,
Dr. Logan, I think your points are well taken, and I do know that you support the bill. Is that not right?
That's correct.
And you probably have some other information that would be valuable to us that you probably have in writing. If you could give us that in writing rather than take up the rest of the time that we have for the meeting, because there's a couple other people I'd like to have testify. If you'd be so kind to do that, I would appreciate it.
My apologies.
And so just wrap up where you are at this point.
My apologies, Madam Chair. And I will stop my testimony then and ask if there's any questions.
Any questions? I hear no questions at this time. We would like the written testimony. And I'd like to call up Dr. John Waller. He's online.
Madam Chair, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Thanks. My name is John Waller. I'm a dentist in private practice in Fairbanks, Alaska, representing Alaska Dental Society. I'd like to speak on, you know, the two parts of this bill. I do believe Dr. Logan provided a lot of very good information on that. Don't have a lot to add, but sometimes when we start dealing with dental issues, it's easy to get caught up in the ethics of the situation, whereas this, I believe, is mainly a business bill as far as, you know, preventing fair practice. And if I could just use as an example, say I'm a small businessman running a small hotel in Fairbanks. And this goes back to, you know, why a dentist would sign up for this plan in the first place. And say I have a small hotel and I have a certain number of rooms that aren't going filled every summer. And I decide to contract with a local tour company, and they're guaranteeing me some more customers in my hotel at cost for the rooms. I'm not making any money at cost on the rooms. I'm bringing people in on the assumptions that, you know, they may dine in my restaurant, they may shop in my gift shop, and they may sign up for some big tours that I put on. In that sense, it's a good business decision. It's an internal marketing decision. By my sense, by offering at rooms, you know, at no profit to myself, whereas I can get patrons in. So on a business standpoint, you know, it doesn't matter where money comes from, if the tourist is paying the money or the tour company is paying money. But for the things as dining at the hotel, shopping in the gift shop, and the tour companies, then I'm allowed to make a profit on those things. Now, if we switch back to the dental model of that, what that basically comes down to, this law would be preventing an insurer to set fees where all of my services are operated at cost. And all of a sudden, as a businessman, it makes the contract a lot less attractable to sign a new one. I don't have any incentive to bring people in to make a profit. Now, how this applies to dentistry and why it's a sticky issue is we're not hotel owners, we're dentists. And we have patients that we care deeply about. And I think this is a ploy by the insurance company to play on that sense of duty to our patients in order to fund a marketing scheme that would be profitable to them. As far as the minimum age set forth, I believe that's very straightforward. My personal experience, I worked at a nonprofit dental home in Minneapolis for 3 years, serving only kids. And I would say half of the kids had no minimum age. We were routinely taking out all of the teeth on 1 and 2 year olds. So a minimum age for dental care, you know, I believe is a very, very commonsensical thing. And I don't really have any detail to add to Dr. Logan's testimony. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? I hear no questions. I'd like to call on Chris Frank.
Thank
Mr. Frank,
you,
are you there?
Madam Chair, members, Chris Frank. I'm with Aetna's Governmental Affairs Department. And we do have some concerns with this bill simply because it seems to be taking away the ability of dental insurers to have contracted rates with our dental providers for both covered and non-covered services. And this is a payment arrangement that's very common in dental contracts. And we think it adds value to our customers because we're able to provide them with predictability on out-of-pocket costs, greater information on what types of fees they could have on various types of dental procedures. And if this is taken away, it could cause some problems in the provider community or in the employer community when they experience complaints due to employee dissatisfaction at increased costs on those employees for non-covered services. What Aetna has done is we've established a fee schedule, and it includes just about every type of cover, every type of service that a dentist can provide. And we offer that fee schedule to the dentist, and the dentist then agreed to be contracted under that fee schedule. What I think this bill may do, and my point only addresses the fee schedule, not the minimum age and not the maximum age, because I don't think those two issues are issues for Aetna. But what it could do is it actually would prevent a dentist from voluntarily agreeing to having these types of services covered, both covered in their negotiated rate, and the definition of what is or is not a covered service then comes into play, because benefits may be covered up to a dollar amount, and after that dollar amount, it's not a covered service. So for orthodontic care, you may have a $3,000 cap or a $2,000 cap on orthodontics, but at some point, you may hit that cap, and then it becomes a non-covered service. Does that mean our members would then be paying, what rate would our members then be charged, since some of the service is covered, some of it's not, due to caps on services or deductibles or things like that? So we would like to think about those two watch outs in the bill if this bill moves forward.
Does that complete your testimony?
That does. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. I'm just curious, though, if we're talking about a service that you do cover or partially cover, that's one thing. But if we're talking about a service that you don't cover, I would think that the only mention of that in the contract would be that was a service that was excluded, just to make it very clear. If something is partially covered, then, you know, that would occur in the pamphlet or the contract or whatever the booklet that people are getting of their services, and indicate that this is a 50% or a set number, $2,500 or whatever. But I'm having trouble understanding why a service that you do not cover would have any mention other than simply that it's an exclusion and not covered by the plan.
Through the chair, Senator, we have a number of different types of contracts. Employers demand flexibility and affordability, so a lot of our contracts are different. Not necessarily our contract with the dentist, but our contract with the employer or the individual could be different and pay for a different covered service depending on what they purchased. So it would be administratively complicated at times to say, okay, for this one individual, this service is covered. For this other individual, it's not covered. That is hard to do from an administrative standpoint when you're trying to establish one common set of fee schedules across the board for all dental services in the state.
All right, thank you. Further question?
So if I understand, you're saying that you have like a single booklet that tells what your services are, and then somehow people are supposed to determine by their employer what services within that pamphlet, rather than having an individual pamphlet for each company or group of companies that you insure with a common plan?
No, I may have misstated. We have a common fee schedule across the state for all the services we provide or that we have contracted with the dentist for. An employer may pick and choose different types of benefits, not the cost, but different types of benefits. For instance, sometimes they include they include orthodontic care. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they put maximums on it. Sometimes they don't. Maximums can range from $1,000 to $3,000. So that is where the fee schedule is the same, but the actual benefits could vary greatly depending on what plan the employer chooses.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Yes, Senator Passman.
Is the fee schedule available for a la carte selection by the consumer?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question because I was muted and then unmuted.
In other words, is the fee schedule available to the consumer on an a la carte basis? In other words, they can pick and choose whatever coverage they do or do not want.
It's not, the fee schedule is not available. I mean, we do have our fees. If a consumer calls up and contacts Aetna and says, what would it cost for X, we can provide them that information. They do not choose to have a benefit. You know, they don't choose, I want that fee schedule for that service. So the costs are provided when asked or when required, when notified by a consumer, but they don't pick and choose which one they want to.
So you do not make that available to the consumer?
Well, we can. I mean, if a consumer calls us up and says, what are my benefits for orthodontic? What will Aetna pay for orthodontic? What's the maximum service or maximum benefit? We can tell them that. Or if they can say, my dental plan is for these services, what is my out-of-pocket exposure? We can tell them that. But if some things are considered covered and some things are considered not, then it becomes very difficult to determine what's going to be a covered benefit and what is not, because the dentist would then have the ability to charge retail or not our contracted rate for some services. And that's where it becomes the unpredictability begins.
Yes.
You know, under an example that's been used recently, I can understand why an insurer that contracts with a specific dentist that says $75 I'll clean a person's teeth, and then there's only two coverages a year. If somebody wanted to have coverage for the third time, you would say there's no coverage. And, you know, I can see why maybe the consumer would say, why do I have to pay more if I want my teeth cleaned a third time, even though it's only covered twice? But I'm struggling with this concept of the mechanism that you established your pricing on, you know, the fee capping pricing structure on non-coverage. In other words, it's not included within your fee structure that you're charging the consumer.
Well, you're right. I think we're saying this. You're right. It's not it wouldn't have a significant impact on Aetna, but it would have an impact on our consumer, our customer, because they would know they wouldn't have the predictability of what something costs. For instance, in your example of cleaning, the cleaning may be $75 twice a year, but if it's $100 if you go a third time because that's not a covered service, that's a good example. Or when it comes to orthodontic care, there may be a cap on the benefit on orthodontic of $2,000, and if you go over that cap, then what do you charge? Then what does the consumer pay? Do they pay the retail rate for the difference between what you will pay as the insurer and what the dentist is going to charge? How do you figure out that difference, and how do you tell the consumer, you know, what the difference is going to be? Because you won't know necessarily what the dentist is going to charge for a complete oral or complete orthodontic care for an adult. They'd have to get both. Here's what Aetna's going to pay $2,000, and then go to their dentist and say, okay, now what's the dentist going to charge if we can't contract for both? So that's why I'm suggesting you may want to think about providing an option for dentists to agree to have both covered and non-covered services provided if they so, you know, provided in their contract with Aetna if they so choose.
Senator Passman.
Yes,
if you don't mind, I would like for this conversation to continue at another committee level, because it's beyond what needs to be covered here in Health and Social Services, and we have just a few minutes before time to close. I do want to say I won't be able to take up the second bill, but I do want to make sure that we take action on 258 while we have the opportunity to do that. The next committee of referral is Labor and Commerce, and that's where those issues need to come up. If I'm overruled by the members here and you do not want to move this bill forward and continue this discussion, we will end at this point and bring it back. But as far as I'm concerned, I see that it's a bill that's worthy of being moved to the next committee of referral, Labor and Commerce. And I would like to move it out of my committee today. I'd like to hear, you know, from the members here. And if you agree to that, I would entertain a motion to do that.
Madam Chair, I think we will make a motion with respect to backslash A version. I would move that we move Senate Bill 258 out of this committee to the next committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objection to that? Here are no objection. 258 moves out of committee.
And if I could just add one comment to Mr. Frank, I'm interested in receiving answers to that and in the mutuality of obligations under contracts and why it's not an a la carte then.
I agree. All right. And also, I just said that we would not be able to take the second bill up, and we will bring that up first thing on Wednesday's schedule. Sorry about the delay on it. We'll adjourn it this time. Thank you, members.